Welcome to Inside the Coaching Mind, conversations on leadership, coaching, and team building. Your host, Terry Pettit, led the University of Nebraska volleyball team from 1977 to 1999 and coached the Cornhuskers to their first national championship in 1995. Today, Coach Pettit mentors fellow coaches, authors books, and presents to corporations and businesses on leadership and team building. Now, without further ado, here's your host, Coach Terry Pettit.
This is Terry Pettit, the host of Inside the Coaching Mind. I'm here with our producer, Dave Pulaski, and our guest, Pauline Theros, who's the director of athletics at Idaho State, and more importantly to our podcast fans, the chair of the NCAA Women's Division I Volleyball Committee, which is charged not only in deciding what 32 teams will join the tournament as large selections to join the 32 that have automatic bids, but also this year will seed the top 32 teams for the first time in history. Up to this point, the committee has been charged with seeding 16 teams. Pauline, welcome to Inside the Coaching Mind.
Thanks, Coach. I'm really excited to be here.
Well, it's a thrill for me, and I watched you on a podcast on Volleyball Magazine, and I just came away feeling, boy, this is really neat that the chair of this committee is this transparent and is willing to talk about it. That was the first thing. The second thing is that you are a volleyball person, and you have, so through high school and college and as an assistant coach, and you've hired coaches, you've been very passionate about the sport. We haven't always had that type of representation. When I looked at the committee today, I noted that 5 of the 10 people on the NCAA committee played college volleyball. I'm sure that we haven't approached that in the past, that at times there might not have been anyone on the committee. So that changes things. And I'm really pleased to have you here today. You played at Idaho State. You were a walk-on. John Potter was the coach. A high percentage of our podcast fans are Nebraska fans. Sure. They know Jay Potter, his twin brother.
Yes.
Jay was my assistant for years. So John was your coach for the first 2 years. And then your final 2 years, you're a middle blocker, and your senior year, you earned all-conference status, I believe, in 2006. You entered the Hall of Fame. What years were you an assistant coach at Idaho State?
I was an assistant coach 95, right after I graduated. I was fortunate to be Bill McLaughlin's assistant through 99. So I coached volleyball for about 5 years on that staff here at Idaho State. And then I was recruited into university development, of all things, at that time. And so I kept my coaching fix by coaching youth volleyball, high school and club, all of the years that I was involved in the university.
Well, you did more than coach. I think you won 6 consecutive Idaho State championships high school that your daughter eventually played at.
Yes, that was lucky. I just had some really talented players come through the program, many of whom were really the fruits of the labor of other coaches who trained them when they were younger, but really, really love coaching. I continue to think about whether or not there's a time in the future when I can return to it, because it's just a great experience to be with students and work with them and help them just achieve all that they're dreaming of. About or just to love the game. I love it.
Pauline, 6 consecutive championships is not luck. You where do you think you got your coaching acumen from? I mean, you must have had really good instincts.
Well, you know, I'm not the best athlete on the planet. I have some size and some strength, but athleticism was never something that came easily to me. And I had to really be a student of the game when I played. I'm the player, it took a lot of reps to get good, and I couldn't stop getting reps or I would lose it quickly. And I had to study the game. I had to have things like perfect feet and good vision I had to use my volleyball IQ to be good. And I think when it came time to be a coach, that did a couple of things for me. It helped me to see how to help, you know, high school players who you get what you get kind of, and you don't know, some of them are great athletes and some of them have to be great in other ways. And it helped me to maximize their talents. And it just, it showed me there are a lot of different ways to win and use talents. And I had a lot of volleyball knowledge when I jumped into the coaching seat because of it.
And you also coach club and you started a club, and tell us about that.
Well, when my daughter began to play at a very young age with my high school team, she would always be at practice and in the gym. She needed a club to play in. And we had an excellent club here in Pocatello, Idaho, Pocatello Elite. It was operated by a woman named Tana Ellis, who just trained the heck out of kids. And that club was prominent in Pocatello for a long time. And she took teams to the Junior Olympics and did very well for a period of years, made quite a name for that club. But as they do, clubs sometimes run their course, people with children that they're operating the club to benefit move on. And we had a need to begin another club, and we called that Idaho Peak. And we drew kids from Pocatello and Idaho Falls and Twin Falls and Rexburg and Rupert. We're talking about a 120-mile radius where kids would come to play. And really just ran a not-for-profit club. Nobody ever took any money out of the club. We were just there to train kids. We ran a break-even operation, tried to get kids on small teams, you know, 7 or 8 kids, and they all played a ton, and we made a lot of teams and got them a lot of reps and some really great experiences going to national qualifiers and doing it with kids that were from other schools and other places. And they'd go back to their high school teams and they would bring something to them that they didn't have before. And so it was a labor of love. And I really, really enjoyed those days in the convention center with kids. It was a lot of fun.
You mentioned that you were recruited out of coaching into the development office. Did you realize what a great move that was for your future when that happened?
I didn't coach. You know, all I knew is I was having a great time coaching volleyball, and I was having as much fun as you could have making like $18,000 a year at the time, right? And I was recruited into a development position because somewhere along the line, my gift of gab kind of was revealed to somebody who was doing some hiring and made like 3 times as much almost instantly. And so my move really was motivated by the fact that I could make a lot more money and just begin a different kind of a career, which I thought was kind of a mature thing to explore at my ripe old age of like 27 when I began in development. So I didn't realize the impact that work would have on me long term. I didn't realize how much I would enjoy it and love it, and how well my natural instincts kind of lent themselves to development. So it was a very fortunate opportunity for me and in my entire history, it's so rare that people spend a whole career at one institution. And I love Idaho State because around every corner, it really has extended an amazing opportunity to me. So very unusual story.
I remember our good friend, Kathy DeBoer, the executive director of the American Volleyball Coaches Association, saying that the path to a higher administrative position is better through development than through the door of being a senior women's administrator. Does that strike you as true? I mean, would you have had the opportunity to be the director of athletics had you not gone through development?
You know, that's hard to say because of my path. I think it is generally true. I do think that obviously development and raising money and improving facilities and providing for things like mental health professionals in our departments and cost of attendance now and nutrition, all of that requires money. And for 80% plus of our institutions, that's not coming from revenue from gate. It's coming from getting out and raising private funds if you want to really take those steps forward. So it's absolutely imperative for an athletic director to be able to raise money. So having that skill, I think, makes you a much better athletic director than not having that skill. But that's not to say that my experience in coaching and even just all of the committees and things that I served on in athletics while I worked in development at Idaho State didn't lend themselves. It's really interesting. You talked about John Potter, and when I wanted to come to Idaho State, and I remember sitting in John Potter's office in Holt Arena, and he was just very straightforward, and he said, you know, you're big, you have some size, you do some good things, you're a really nice kid, I like what you bring. I want you to know you're not going to get a scholarship, and you know what? You'll probably never play, but I want you on the team. And it's a really good thing that the only thing that I heard or that registered in my brain that day was I want you on the team. It literally is the only thing I heard, and I was happy as a clam. And I really, you know, I just devoted all of my efforts to trying to get good and trying to earn a place on that team, and eventually did, and the rest is history. But when I became interim athletic director, when our new president invited me to do that, it was A, because I had had some experience with him through development projects that we worked on during his, at the time, short tenure since he arrived. And he said to me in that very first interaction when he appointed me that, now, this is a temporary appointment. You won't be a candidate for this position. And at that time, I had always wanted to be involved in athletics and had, you know, thoughts of being an athletic director, but I had gone way too far. I was an associate vice president of development, and getting into athletics somewhere at an entry level would have been a significant step back and a risky one. And I remember thinking, maybe this is like that day in John Potter's office when he said I wouldn't play and I wouldn't earn a scholarship. So I just learned to come from a place of yes, and then let's try to knock it out of the park. So I think SWAs, there's two things that might give them a slower path. And this is anecdotal, but there's some research that supports it too. You know, primarily they are responsible for gender equity, and they really live in that world of monitoring and promoting that. And there are a lot of very internal functions, right? And a lot of hands-on programmatic things with student athletes in the traditional role. Now, there are some that are different. And so sometimes I don't think we do a good enough job of getting our SWAs experience in the external realm of being an athletic director. And that is, we know, is just very, very important. So I think we have to do a better job of grooming our women in leadership for those opportunities if they are internally focused like they often are.
How does someone get on the Division I volleyball committee? What's the selection process?
So you have to be nominated by your conference. And each conference, there is a rotation because obviously not every conference has someone on the committee at all times. So there's a rotation. And when your conference comes up and they have the opportunity to nominate someone from one of their member institutions, they do that. And then the NCAA nominating committee makes recommendations, vets, and the existing committee also has the opportunity to review those nominations and provide some feedback to the nominating committee, and then you are selected.
But there's no requirement that person has to have had experience either as a competitor or as a coach or even an administrator of that sport. Is that correct?
That's correct. Although everything on the application that you complete, those questions are asked. Do you have experience? What is your background? So that information is provided, but obviously over the years there have been people who have had less of a volleyball background than others. And I think we're fortunate that now we're starting to get more formal volleyball student athletes, more women who played volleyball, who are now involved in leadership and in administrative positions, who are available to serve. So I think the pool, in all fairness, is getting larger than it ever has been before.
And it may be for women. Conversely, it might not for men, because we're seeing more and more athletic directors with MBAs than we are former coaches and former athletes. But in your committee, 5 of the 10 people played college volleyball. And I think that that is impressive. Talk about how they, when does this committee really begin its work? At what point in the year, is it August or late summer that you begin getting together and talking about the season?
Well, you know, interestingly, we have pretty regular meetings, I would say, in the off season, after the February meeting where we come together and kind of evaluate championships. We are still getting together on the phone maybe every 5 or 6 weeks to, you know, talk about the next championship, talk about what the membership is advocating for, how can we advocate for those things inside the NCAA from our position as the committee? How are we going to interact with coaches? I think this year we did something that was very productive in meeting with a group of coaches at JO's, which it was, by the way, fun for me to get back in a convention center, but they're all there, right? So we went there in late in June or early July, whenever that was, and we were able to have a discussion about things that were important to coaches. We were able to answer questions about how selections work, and they brought some suggestions about, you know, other measures or other criteria that might bring value, and what did we think of those? And they talked about the championships, what they thought could be improved, spoke very candidly about the television coverage that we were getting, not only at championships, but for the sport as a whole, and what were things that we could all advocate for together and do together to increase that, because our sport is growing. The public is really, I think, responding to the sport of volleyball. And I think it's a time in our history when we need to take advantage of that. So I thought that was excellent. And it's something that should continue to happen. I think it just improves the level of trust and transparency between the committee and the coaching group when we can have those discussions. And it just helps to inform our work. So that was in the middle of the summer. And then, boy, the end of July, we are looking at volleyball schedules for teams across the country. We're assigning our committee members to regional advisory committees. We're, you know, determining what things are going to look like in terms of watching volleyball, what we're going to schedule to make sure we all see different and similar matches. How are we going to advocate with ESPN, for instance, for coverage, and what suggestions are we going to have? So it is quite a heavy lift from very early in August all the way through December through championships, which is really interesting if you're at an institution that has football, because that's a very crazy time of year. And then we take a little break and we have our meeting in February to start planning for the next year. So it's a considerable commitment.
Yeah, I do want to make this note. You may be the first person who's coached college volleyball who ever said, "I was eager to get back in a convention center."
I love it, Coach. I love it.
So how many regions are there? When you said the country's divided into how many regions?
So there's 5 regions, and there's 2 committee members that serve on each rack.
Okay. And so those people are, their first priority is watching teams from those regions, correct?
Yes. We want to become familiar with the conferences and the teams in those regions and watch the important matches. And probably the most valuable thing is we meet every other week with that regional advisory committee. So one coach who is a representative of each conference in your region. We come together once a week and they make a top 10 ranking for their region which we take all that data, we pull it together, combine their votes and produce one singular top 10 for the region. And then we come together and discuss that. And we get really valuable insights from those coaches in the conferences talking about the teams to watch, the matches to watch, you know, who's doing something extraordinary, who do they think deserves consideration and why. And it's just a really good tool to be another piece of data that informs things behind the RPI. So I think those discussions are extremely helpful. And I have yet to go to one of those RAC meetings where I don't get a new insight that I hadn't thought of myself.
And most of our listeners understand what RPI is, but for those who don't, explain the formula.
Well, the formula, the RPI is based on winning percentage. It's solely on winning percentage. So 25% of the formula is a team's own winning percentage. 50% is the winning percentage of opponents. And then 25% is the winning percentage of your opponent's opponents. So it very heavily weights strength of schedule and how frequently teams win. And that's where the ranking comes from. In essence, the, you know, 1 through 344. And I think it's really important to distinguish between that ranking and the what the RPI tool actually offers, because it includes layers and layers of information, which allows a much closer look at how all those wins and losses shake out. You can pull and compare teams by schedule, their wins. You can look closely at their common opponents and how they both performed against those common opponents. And quite often, more often than not, there are common opponents that exist. The quality wins home and away. Did you get that big win on the road or away? And that comes into consideration. You can easily evaluate the last 10 matches. And just what does the team sheet of a loss look like? How bad really is that loss and how good really is that win? So,
but I want to make one point of clarification here. When you mentioned how badly a team won or lost, that's not built into the RPI formula.
No,
correct?
No, it is.
It's not even, the RPI doesn't even consider whether or not you won 3-0 or whether you won 3-2.
No, it doesn't. It does include that data in the pool. And so therein lies the rub. When you talk about using the RPI to make selections, what you can be critical of is that ranking itself. That is a limited look at a team's performance, that ranking.
But if you don't look at these other variables.
Sure. But all of the data that is there for the taking, and you have to dive into it. And I our committee is very, very, number one, well-practiced at that, because as much as the reveals are to spark attention and get people talking, which is an important purpose of the two reveals that we did, they also exist to give our committee, and especially our newer members, practice at finding and digesting and discussing all of the information that's available in the tool.
Some of our listeners would be familiar with the Pablo system of ranking, which does have built into it percentages of the number of sets that were played, the scores, etc. Does your committee ever look at the Pablo rankings?
I think all of the members of our committee look at the Pablo rankings, but it's important. You know, we take very seriously that the membership has a set criteria that we are supposed to base selections on. And so selection is based on all of the information in the RPI regarding those criteria, strength of schedule, common opponents, win-loss record, all of those things. But Pablo or the KPI or Massey or even the coaches' polls, it's important to look at those and see what are the similarities, what are the differences, and before you cast a vote in good conscience, you should try to understand why those exist. And so they do bring some value and they do inform the process. But what you're looking for in those other tools is, am I finding evidence that supports what these wins and losses are telling me at a team? Or am I finding evidence that tells me that this win wasn't as good or as valuable as it looks? So there, you know, there's a lot of data.
One potential vulnerability in RPI is that when 50% of it is made up of your opponent's winning percentage, if you're Idaho State, you are going to have to travel quite a ways to play against a team that wins a conference that you can be highly competitive with, as opposed to going to the Pac-12, maybe, or the Big West, et cetera. But if you're in the eastern third of the United States or the Midwest, it is much easier, both in terms of travel and financially, to schedule teams that are going to have a high winning percentage that you can be competitive with. How does the committee deal with that?
Well, that becomes very subjective to try to think about those types of variables. But I think it is a bias of the RPI. But you do look at that non-conference, and there are conversations where you're saying a team, boy, this team did everything they could. They went out, they scheduled, they traveled across the country. Goodness knows, I've looked at my budget enough to tell you that Idaho State has traveled to the East Coast to get wins or to get the kinds of matches they want. Conferences build, you know, coaches come up with tiered scheduling. The top tier of the conference should schedule in this manner, and the middle tier in this manner, and the bottom tier just schedule to get wins. And everybody tries to do that. And I think that's why it's important, because we've given this information to the membership and they're trying to achieve what they need to achieve to get in. So it's important that we don't ever go rogue with selections and go crazy, because the rules of engagement exist, right? But I think that wins matter, no matter who you're able to schedule or where you're able to go. And that non-conference schedule comes in to play, but it's more, obviously, it's more influential if you can get top 10 teams in there, wherever they are in the country. So there does exist that bias, but I think teams have done a great job scheduling to the best of their ability and the best of their budget.
If you're not in a Power 5 conference, though, it's harder to get a top ranked team to come into your place. At best, you might get a 3-for-1 situation where you travel to UCLA two or three times and maybe they might come to your place. So RPI is a major part of determining what teams are in and the seeding. You mentioned the last 10 competitions.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Okay. So there's a focus on how teams are doing at the end of the season. What happens if you've done a good job scheduling and maybe you've beaten a couple Power 5 teams in the preseason and you've scheduled them, but your last 10 matches are against conference teams that you're significantly stronger than?
Yeah.
So that inevitably hurts you, doesn't it?
Well, it does. It hurts you in the ranking, right? It hurts you in that RPI ranking, and that's why you have to look deeper. So a perfect example that we're probably all talking about is San Diego. You know, they did what they needed to do early in the season. They came up with some great top 10 wins, and they are burning their way through the WCC. And I think it isn't right to penalize them for, you know, a conference that maybe is not as strong as some other conferences. They did what they needed to do in the preseason. They've held a relatively high spot during the early reveals, and they are taking care of business. They're not just winning ho-hum in their league. They're taking care of business, and that counts. And I think ultimately, when you get down and you look at this team, have they done everything that they could do? Have they shown evidence that they can beat a top 10, a top 25 team? Yes, they did show evidence of that. Now you see that they're burning through their conference, and you have to know that good volleyball is still good volleyball. What are their hitting efficiencies? What do they look like? This is why we watch so much. And I suspect that years ago, the committee did not watch nearly as much. We are watching, among the 10 of us, hundreds and hundreds of matches. And thank goodness that all of the conferences have done such a good job of developing platforms where now this is all available to consume. You can consume the live stream. You can go get it on demand. God forbid, if you have to watch it on Volumetrics, you can. And this is where volleyball knowledge comes in. Very important. You watch that team play, and what do you think of the level of volleyball that they are playing? And ultimately, can they compete at the level where you're going to see them? And at some point, we have to look at the statistics, the RPI. You can't penalize them really for the league that they're in. They have evidence that they can perform well. Now, what do you think of that team? And it comes down to the individual vote on that matter with all of the information that you have.
I'm biased. Yeah. I trust my eye test, but there's a lot of, but whether or not, and I would trust Beth Lanier's eye test, and I would trust Don Shaw's eye test, but I also know I can go watch a Division II match against two teams that are equally talented, and they can be fantastic. The play is great. The training is great. They're doing everything that we do at the highest level in Division I. But that doesn't necessarily mean I can predict whether one of those teams could go play against a top 10 team in Division I. So that's the part that leaves me a little skeptical. And I also know that someone like you, who's been involved with volleyball, I would tend to trust your eyes maybe better than one of these five committee members who has not spent a life in volleyball. I'm just take that for what it's worth.
No, it's a valid point, Coach. And we talk about, for me, the most important thing is as many points of data or information as possible. And the best you can do is do these all point in the same direction. So it may not be simply the eye test on a team. That's never the only reason. But does the eye test support, you know, some of the evidence from the non-con and what the statistics are saying and the strong win-loss? And if it all points in the same direction, you're probably doing pretty well. And that's also the reason for the racks. And it's also the reason, you know, you can get an idea of what coaches think by where they're ranking teams in the AVCA poll. You can get an idea of the nuances and the skill of a team by what the coaches in their region are saying about them. And you just, in the end, you take as much as you can as, in the course of that season, and you hope it all supports in a valid way the conclusion that you're making. And you have to recognize the differences too. And I saw something about this on Twitter. Why are the coaches' polls different from the committee rankings? And the interesting thing is I do look at these for perspective. I think it's fascinating. And they're not always that disparate. I mean, they often include some of the same teams with some different ordering. And sometimes it seems that there's maybe a lag, but then you notice maybe after a reveal, here it is 10 or so days later, and a lot of the polls I'm seeing are a lot closer to that reveal. So there are similarities, but the differences are, and I think two things are prominent in that. The coaches' polls are very, they're based on opinion. And the committee rankings are much more computational, with an effort to confirm, you know, those calculated results with what statistics tell you, with what the eye test tells you, and maybe with what the RAC feedback looks like. So,
and I want to remind our listeners, RAC is the Regional Advisory Committee. So your first charge is who are the 32 at-large teams, correct?
Yes.
And how long, how many hours does it take? I'm assuming that I could be way off here, but I'm assuming that maybe 24 of those are relatively easy to determine they're going to receive at-large bids.
Yeah, that's interesting because honestly, Coach, when I recorded my initial vote this year for our first top 10 reveal, my comment to the group when I submitted my list to help us get started was that, you know, after number two, this gets really muddy. And I meant it. It was so true. And I believe this year it feels more close to that than my previous 3 years because the sport is growing and parity is increasing. And we're seeing just the tip of the iceberg of so many of the outcomes the membership has worked for over time. Teams are getting better.
Yeah, we're not talking about seeding now. We're talking about at-large bids.
Yeah, we're talking about at-large bids, but they're all equally as hard. All of them are hard because truly we are seeding that 32, and then they're just very hard because whether you're talking about the first 10 or the first 16, those are really difficult because you know, you're giving someone the opportunity to host, which is very impactful. And when you get down to the at-large and you're talking about the last four in, those are equally as difficult.
Oh, but, I would think that that's very difficult.
Oh, now you're making a decision that's going to leave some of them home. And all across the bracket, the obligation to the membership and the responsibility we feel with every vote is immense for every single one of those spots that we select.
How long does it take to decide what 64 teams are in the tournament?
Well, this year it's going to probably take longer than ever. We're going to start much earlier on Friday than normal. But, if memory serves, we normally begin about noon on Friday, and it is Saturday evening before we're putting the finishing touches on the teams that we have bracketed. It takes easily 48 hours to seed the 16 and then fill in the rest of the at-larges. So I think it will take more time this year and be more difficult.
Has the committee that has to be fatiguing. And I've been on a rules committee that went to 3 a.m. deciding if we were going to have a libero or not. And by the end, it passed simply because some people just threw up their hands and said, all right, I'm tired. Has the rules committee ever considered having a person who watches volleyball, is familiar with volleyball, come in after you've set up the bracket and look at it and say, you know, I see something, it looks great, or I see something, have you considered this?
No. I mean, we depend upon our committee for that. And right or wrong, that is the way it is structured at this time. I'm not sure how that would work. I think that it could bring value and it could bring some merit. This group just gets so deep within the numbers and the statistics. And the good thing about it is that, you know, we take very intentional breaks. We take time there. Matches are happening while we're making selections. We're watching them all. The room is full of big screens. And it's really important that as you make decisions, you back up and you look at them again and you make sure that you still feel the same and that the data all points in the same direction. I think the fact that this really, you know, every seed is based on 10 individual votes, you know, the committee votes. And so there are different perspectives who are seeing and discussing different things throughout the course of selections. But no, that's never been discussed, and it certainly is not part of the process.
Right. So you're voting. There's not a consensus. A consensus isn't reached that, all right, we all pretty much agree after this discussion, so-and-so should be a number one seed.
Yeah, many of the times that is the case, but you cast the vote anyway. And then as you move through the seeds, there are times when we're splitting hairs between a team and we don't reach a consensus and we say, okay, it's just time to vote.
And if you're a number one seed, should you advance to the round of 16, you get to host a regional.
Yes. One through four can host all the way through as long as they keep winning.
What are the requirements in hosting a regional? Are there attendance requirements?
There are not hard attendance requirements. I think there have been in the past, but there are minimum bids. Everyone still submits a bid. So whether attendance supports that bid or not, an institution is on the hook financially for that.
Aren't you also interested in, I mean, you wouldn't want to have a number one bid have 1,500 people.
No, we wouldn't. And that has happened. That has most certainly happened. And that is one of the drawbacks of earning the right to host based on, on your seed. There simply are some locations that even though the volleyball is terrific, they don't draw the same as you maybe draw in some of the locations that we see in the Midwest.
Right. Okay. So as I understand it, you go through all the number one seeds, you go through all the number two seeds, but you're also, when we say number one seeds, you have a 1, 2, 3, and 4, correct?
Yes.
Okay. And the same with the number twos.
Correct.
And this year you'll be able to do that through the top 32 teams.
Correct. So we will seed 1 to 32. So a number one all the way to a number 32. 1 through 4 will be ones, and 5 through 8 will be twos, and so on, so that you have 4 ones, 4 twos, 4 threes, all the way through 4 eights. And those will represent all of the ones and twos. So at every site, you'll have a 1, which will play an 8. And of the 4 8s, the geography will come into play. So of those 4 8s, if one of them can drive and avoid a flight, that's the one that will go to that host site.
That's not a complete seeding then. Right.
That's right. It's seeded across the lines of 8. So geography still comes in to this model.
Right. So you might be the best team in the country, but you might be playing the best 8 seed.
That could happen. So the number one, specifically of the 4 8s they could play, if all things are equal, they'll play the 32 as long as 31 is not within the 400 miles. So they might play the 32, they might play the 31, and so forth.
But only
4 teams that they can play.
So theoretically, you could still have a situation, let's say Utah's ranked number one, and BYU is an 8 seed, they still could end up playing each other.
They still could, but as the person who was the site rep at that location the last 2 years in a row, that is much more unlikely. That is much more unlikely with this model, because there are only 4 spots that one of those 2 teams could occupy where they would end up playing the other. So it would be much more rare. And that's why when we originally proposed this change, we did write into the proposal that it should be considered that a team would not go to the same place, 2 years in a row or within a 3-year experience or something of that nature. And that did not become part of the pilot, but this is a start, and this is something, we're going to monitor, and hopefully, the committee will continue to put pressure on this if we continue to have that problem.
Okay.
I believe this will alleviate the majority of those issues.
Right. We had years where I believe Michigan played Stanford 3 years in a row.
Yeah.
A lot of those things.
And those are so unfortunate from the standpoint of what the student athlete's experience is. That's we felt that we could do better. And it is taking, I'm sure it will be a significant investment for the NCAA to do it this way. And I'm very appreciative of that investment. I think it'll make a big difference and hopefully provide and demonstrate a improvement to the tournament that we want to continue.
What are some things that this committee has advocated to the Rules Committee in the past?
Well, to the Rules Committee, examples are not as frequent in my mind as it is. We have not focused as much on rules. We've given feedback on rules that that committee has proposed, and at times, because coaches have so much input there. And so I think that the committee is less needed to advocate for rules because coaches truly have a lot of input there. Things that we have advocated for successfully have been more along the lines of, for example, the day in between regionals, the seeding change, and really working towards wanting to get 64 teams seeded. Those are the types of things that have been important. And even for the summer access, the committee absolutely has weighed in upon that because we are watching an awful lot of volleyball in August, and we're all on campuses and we can see the impact that, you know, that lack of committed training right before the season has. And our committee did advocate that, you know, I think summer access is important for fall sports. So those are the types of things, and really anything that comes up in discussion with the coaching membership that has merit, I think we're comfortable considering and advocating for, and it's something that we should do.
I shared with somebody, I would bring this up. You mentioned early success, San Diego having early success. I believe it was Towson went into Pittsburgh. Mm-hmm. And won at Pitt 3-1. So the first thing I did was look up Towson on the internet and found out that really well-coached team has had great success for several years. How does that win? You know, they don't have the opportunity to play many teams at that level. Probably won't be invited back next year. But how does that win that took place in September impact where Towson might be seeded?
It'll favorably impact it for sure, but it depends how they continue to perform through the year. You know, an early win, and it's a great win, is one thing, but then what about their loss to Elon? What does that tell you about their performance? You have a great win, you have kind of an ugly loss. Do those completely even each other out? I think those are mitigated by the fact that Towson is, you know, they haven't lost much. And to stumble, much the way that maybe Pitt did when they played Towson, is to be expected. So I think their RPI is now in the low 40s. That's dramatically better than it was at the beginning of the season. That team's rack continues to speak very, very highly of them. And so that win is a piece of evidence that points to the fact that they can compete with all of the teams in the tournament, right? And the more of that evidence you have, the more likely that you are to be selected. So they certainly have as much evidence of that as any team in their RPI range. Yeah. So when we begin to line those up against one another, it will be a question of, is that win over Pitt more evidence than another deserving team in about the same range that we compare them to? So it absolutely helps them. They're rewarded for it.
What about an injured player? Anna DeBeer is a great outside hitter for Louisville, perhaps one of the best six rotation players in the country. Right. And she's been out with an injury, but I presume is returning soon. How does that impact the committee's discussion on a team?
Absolutely. When there are losses, and here's to Louisville's credit, what they're doing without DeBeer is extraordinary, right? They've performed quite well, but her absence in a major loss it's something that, you know, explains a part of that loss. It certainly is a factor. It doesn't eliminate the loss. The loss is there. That performance has to be considered as a data point. But also, if you are comparing them to another team and you're saying there was this loss during this period, but they did not have arguably their best player, then you have reason to believe this team still is in a favorable position for a high seed. If all other business is handled and taken care of, and there are losses that sometimes a team has two losses in a row that are a little bit uncharacteristic for their level, but you look at it and you say, well, those two losses, they did not have their setter. That kind of explains why they stumbled. Should that be weighed against them as heavily as other losses that can't be explained by some factor like that? So absolutely those discussions happen. Yeah,
Northwestern has had a couple of very nice wins this year. Went five sets with Nebraska this last week. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, their setter chased down a ball into the press stand, was carried off in a stretcher. I've heard some good news that, you know, she's going to be okay, but they may not have a setter until the original starting setter returns. How do you look at a situation like that?
I that's going to be one of the really hard ones. You look at that and they might take some losses for that reason. And then when she does come back, is she able to come back fully? Is that going to be the same team? You know, if you can make an argument that a team is going to return at the same strength, but we still will have to have some evidence of that. Does she get back? Is she playing? Do you see her with your own two eyes able to perform? And that's going to make you feel differently if they drop some sets in the interim before she comes back. And those are the things that become subjective in this process that are probably, some people would argue that that's a strength of the process, that those things matter. And other people who are more just about the data would argue that it's a weakness. So
Pauline, what's the most misunderstood thing about the role of the committee, the process that the committee takes?
You know, what I see is that, you know, a lot of people, if the ultimate rankings are anywhere near that RPI ranking, I think the biggest misconception is that that number is what drives the process, when it's not. It's all these layers of information that we're talking about that are underneath. And the second misconception is that, and Lee actually asked me about this, is that we project things into the bracket. You know, he had mentioned a Final Four, or a regional that had four female coaches in it, and that, hey, that was great. But he said, shouldn't you really have planned it so that they were all in a different regional, so they all had a chance to go to the Final Four? And we don't place teams in the bracket until after they're all seeded. The focus is really on deciding their individual rightful place in that 1-32 seeding before we ever look at the bracket. And then there are bracketing principles and basically a platform that does the bracketing for you. So we're not projecting to say, well, it would be way too soon for Minnesota and Stanford to match, so let's seed them a little bit differently.
Right. That doesn't happen. When you have evaluated last year's bracket or the previous year, have you noticed any patterns that made you curious?
Wow, you're really testing me here. As for trends, you know, that might be evident from last year, it's always something I do. I look at that to gain some perspective, and maybe more than anything else, to measure how well we did our job, right? So last year's regional semifinals included two unseeded teams. I believe they were Kansas and Illinois. And that could speak to the fact, I think one of the tweets said, do we still have Cinderellas in this tournament? And I think you do. I just am wired to believe that every matchup has a Cinderella. But two unseeded teams made it that far. And going forward from there, the final eight included the four top seeds, and then 6, 8, 10, 12, and then three of the top four seeds and a 10, Nebraska, survived for the final four. And then we saw 4 versus 10 in the final. So you could look at this and say, I can pat myself on the back and say it's well seeded, right? Because we had three of the final four that we seeded top four. But you could argue that Nebraska making it in the number 10 seed was a Cinderella of sorts. So if you look at it in that way and you look at the final results, you feel like we're doing something right. And this tournament has the elements of being able to get to a final match, even if you're seated 10 or 11. But it also speaks to the fact that when teams hold seed, maybe you're getting the seeding right. So teams peak at different times. It's hard to draw too many conclusions from that, but ultimately it seems to me that the best teams are working their way appropriate through the bracket.
Pauline, as we move to close our chat here, and I've really appreciated your openness in this. Your daughter Zoe is the leading point getter on Gonzaga's volleyball team as an outside hitter. She's a senior, and is she going to return for her fifth year next year?
Yes, she is going to come back for a fifth year.
And how many times have you gotten to see her play live this season?
I've gotten to see her play this season live once, and it actually was Idaho State University went to Gonzaga's tournament. Gonzaga will return that here at Idaho State next year. And coincidentally, I am doing the unthinkable tomorrow, and I am flying to Spokane to watch her last two home matches, and I am missing a football weekend. We're on the road for football, but
That's not unthinkable. That's what you should be doing.
Yeah. I try to get up there twice a year. If I can see four matches in person, then I'm happy.
Well, I want to thank you for your leadership. I want to thank you for your passion. It's great to have an advocate for the sport in the role that you're in. And I wish you good luck, you and your committee. And we're really fortunate to be at a time when the interest in women's volleyball is exploding. I think I shared with you earlier that a very prominent soccer coach, men's soccer coach, told me that he thought that women's volleyball would become the premier men's or women's sport sometime in the next decade. And when I asked him why, he said it was it's because it's a sport that's violent, but no one gets hurt. Well, sometimes they do get hurt, but it's amazing the coverage we're getting. And I'm sure some of that is the result of your committee's work. Thank you so much for being a guest on Inside the Coaching Mind.
Thanks so much, Coach. It's a pleasure.
Thanks for listening to Inside the Coaching Mind with Coach Terry Pettit. Tune in next time as we welcome in another guest to talk leadership, coaching, and team building. Inside the Coaching Mind is presented in collaboration with Learfield.